You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 3rd of July. How'd that happen? July, that's crazy.
Know. Crazy, isn't it?
I'm your host Mary Margaret and I'm joined in studio by producers Connor Nell and Sam Smith. What's up guys?
Kia ora.
Hello.
Connor's just been at Munchie Mart.
I have.
The old goodie.
I've got my chilli crab crisps with me there.
Have they renovated to downstairs yet?
They have, yeah.
Oh shit.
It's all very shiny and very new and much more space. Further away.
Yeah. They used to like yell at you like, line up, and
line
I was like,
three.
Oh my gosh.
Cash in line three.
Yeah, they're crazy.
Yeah. No, it's much less crazy there. It's a much more peaceful.
And well, especially now because there's nobody other students fluffing around.
Yeah.
On the show today, Sam talks to a politics lecturer from Aston University. It's in Poland, isn't it?
Well, no, Aston University is in the UK, but she is Polish.
She is Polish. Yes. She's a very cool name. He's talking to her about an article that she wrote on Childish Gambino's poignant video, This Is America. I asked the Council of Trade Unions Vice President about how the gender pay principles announced by the government last night will impact pay equity. In his international segment this week, Connor does some myth-busting about farm attacks in South Africa.
Yes, we are going to cut through all the bullshit that
all the red tape.
Is spread on the internet by racists and Afrikaner nationalists. And
classic BFM, yeah. Eh?
That's what I'm going to do. You rail against the system.
Laura Quigstad learns about a new alcohol interlock sentence initiated by the government due to the prevalence of drink driving here. And our Green Desk friend Jack Marshall learns about new research into how Australian moths use magnetic fields to migrate. Busy show today.
Packed.
Yeah, exactly. Packed. He aha o whakaaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have. Tukupa tuhi mai. You can text us on 5395 or wire mai, give us a call on 309 3879.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Well then, music and politics. It's always had a very strong relationship, going back to the days of the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and campaigns to combat racism. These days, artists such as Childish Gambino are pushing the boundaries visually and musically when it comes to using their art as a political vehicle. Well, I was very fortunate to speak to Pat Rosbikia, who is a lecturer in politics at Aston University. She co-authored an article called As Childish Gambino Shows, Pop Music Can Be Powerfully Political. I spoke to her. Do you think that censorship in music is still a big issue these days, or have artists found ways to kind of get around this?
It's definitely not the issue of like 1960s, 70s and even 1980s. It's more focused about, it's very marginalized aspect of the whole music industry. And in our research, we actually discovered that it's more about like market censorship. So it's not necessarily relevant to the politics. It's only the market itself steers it. So political songs, the ones which are very expressive about current situation, they're actually not very popular on the market, so they don't sell well, so they don't reach that many masses. So it's not really an issue that maybe they're not there, it's just they are not as visible as before.
Do you think music has become more or less political these days? And do you think with that, does it still have the ability to influence change, perhaps like it used to?
I would say the scale is different. So before we have like historical examples, so we have like huge movements. There is like Red Wedge movement in UK. We have like Rock the Vote, Rock Against Racism. So we have really big initiatives. And at this moment, we don't have this big kind of scale involvement from people. But also on the other side, it's the micropop activism which is popping up, becoming very active. So rather small scale gigs, but there's more of them. So kind of using a bit an idea of Rock Against Racism. So organizing tons of little activities which actually create bigger awareness and getting people more, well, again, more aware of the issue rather than like just huge initiative.
So why do you think that these changes have taken place?
I think it's definitely coming with technology, because we have like availability of like 24/7 news cycle. And then to be honest, something to stay on the news agenda, it really has to be big and shocking. And to be honest, all those micropop activism events, gigs, and so on, they're so tiny that they don't manage to kind of pop up long enough. So definitely technology aspect. The other issue is, like, let's take YouTube and Childish Gambino example. He posts online video, which gets picked up by SNL, so Saturday Night Live, put it on TV, and then it gets, like, up to, like, tons and millions of views. And it's all because of technology, and everyone gets aware of it. And then we have spin-offs like This Is Nigeria, there's also version in India, and so on. And it's all wonderful, but without the technology and the development in streaming, YouTube aspect, and Facebook, when the sharing is even more possible, it wouldn't happen on the same scale.
So I guess this is a good time to talk about social media. Do you think it's made it more easier for artists to be political and to get their views to their fans? And with this, I guess, is there an expectation now on musicians that they should use their platforms for this?
There's definitely a push for actually encouraging, especially, like, new up-and-coming artists to use social media. Definitely we have, like, celebrity culture when, like, Twitter followers are becoming, like, and, well, not necessarily engaged in politics, but celebrity, for example, suggesting support for particular or endorsing particular politician is definitely a force which can encourage a change of view and definitely getting youngsters involved, because that's the main user. So we're talking about the youngest generation of potential voters, so 18, 24.
How effective do you think music is in creating political change or engaging people politically? Are things like benefit concerts or charity singles effective, or are they more kind of cynical attempts by musicians to seem like they care?
I don't want to be very pessimistic. So maybe let's look at it from the perspective gig goers, event goers, festival goers. All the events they attend is actually preaching to the choir. So you will not see, for example, conservative supporters on the gigs organized by the Labour and so on. So it's not necessarily about change of political views. It's rather kind of making them a bit stronger and kind of giving the people a chance to, like, voice it, get, like, interaction with people with the same views. But having said that, so it's not necessarily about change of political views. It's more about making people more aware of what the issues are. And that's the potential of music, that it can be brought to the politics and in general kind of larger movement.
Let's turn to the election of Donald Trump and his kind of relationship with musicians and politics. Because do you think he's acted as a catalyst for greater political engagement from musicians?
No, definitely not. Because lots of people forget that engagement of musicians in the US actually precedes Donald Trump quite a lot. So just to give you more recent examples, let's talk, like, when Obama was first the candidate, then the president, there was a huge support from a number of musicians. We have Beyoncé, which was very supportive. We have Katy Perry, which was very active on the Clinton's campaign. So I wouldn't say that the activity kind of got bigger or more visible, because also the negative examples are there. We have Dixie Chicks, which were banned for talking against, speaking against Bush and other types of actors. So Trump coming in is neither the kind of new exciting example or neither a very negative or positive example. So it was all there before, and it just kind of gets highlighted because Trump uses Twitter. He has, like, millions, I think 52 millions of followers. And then he starts tweeting about it and it just kind of spreads a bit more. So it's not necessarily a new phenomenon. Sure. It just gets highlighted.
Right. So you mentioned musicians and how they've supported politicians in the past, etc. What about politicians trying to get musicians to support them or endorse them? Does this have meaning to it, or is it just kind of more the celebritization of politics?
I would say it is a bit about celebrity endorsement kind of getting more popular and so on. And when I was just, like, thinking about it in advance, I was like, okay, so Trump has 52 million followers on Twitter. Kanye West has, like, over 28 million. Other examples, like Beyoncé, has 15 million or even more at this moment. So basically a message transferred through their Twitter account, which is so much more people, so many more people. It's not necessarily even about the message itself. It's just about the fact that it gets to more people. There are some different examples across the world. I work mostly on US and in UK, so that's the easiest one. But it kind of links to your earlier questions with use of technology. So this combination at the moment, well, at the moment, last 20 years, allows for this kind of particular celebrity endorsement fact. But again, it's not very new phenomenon. If we compare it to, for example, movie industry, actors endorsing politicians, again, nothing new. It's something which started up very early with the Hollywood golden times.
Now, there was an example in the UK last year with Jeremy Corbyn, and he became heavily endorsed by the Grime movement, which in fact led to a voter registration drive called Grime for Corbyn. It also became quite a meme as well. It was quite funny. What happened here? Can you explain that a bit more? And was it successful?
It was extremely interesting social experiment, I would say. In the sense that a lot of Grime stars endorsed Jeremy Corbyn, and we have Stormzy, GME, Novelist, a lot of them who simply made a statement. They haven't voted before, but now they're getting more interested in the politics. Did it have effect? Well, the whole campaign of Labour leading to 2017 elections, next to the typical political rallies, included a lot of gigs and smaller scale festivals, but mostly appearances of Jeremy Corbyn at different events, including the famous speech during the Glastonbury in 2017. Which, interestingly enough, it's not only the participants of Glastonbury, but also because it was televised, it reached almost 18 million people. So the idea is that the goal was to get, not necessarily, again, not to change political views. It's rather to get those festival goers and so on, which on average are actually Labour supporters anyway, to actually get them mobilised to go voting. The rise in numbers of like first-time voters wasn't gigantic, but taking a really low numbers for the last 20 years, starting from like 1992, of really low turnout of young people, this was actually a big success. However, we can't really strictly link it just to those activities. Definitely, they got like a bit more interested. There were options of like registering for the vote system. There was a lot of information available during those kind of events. But again, there's no strict link that we can say 100% that that was the effect of it. But then, you know, there are some amazing things which like haven't been seen since like new Labour affair with Britpop from like beginning of 1990s, when people are chanting "Oh Jeremy Corbyn" to like the White Stripes songs from like 2003, which is a phenomenal in the sense that young people get engaged, not necessarily through traditional forms, but it more like political engagement through untraditional means. So they're getting a bit more aware of the situation, and I think that's the largest success of the whole process. Because who knows, maybe they haven't voted necessarily in the 2017 elections, but they're going to grow up till the next elections. They have a few years, and it's very probable that in the next election they will be more willing to actually go voting because they're going to be more aware of situation, problems, potential solutions.
That's a good time to talk about the future. Do you think music and politics is going to become more of a closer relationship, or do you think it's going to decline as such?
That's an interesting one. I think we can't really say it ever went that far away from each other.
Right.
Again, as mentioned before, it's not a new phenomenon. It's just we have a tendency to forget a lot of examples. Just to kind of bring in something which we just recently worked on with another colleague, Labour Life. So last week in events when Labour organised a big Labour festival, we have Jeremy Corbyn coming to the stage and talking about how politics and music going to be together. This is like first time when we're going to organise this big thing, and it's going to like next year it's going to be bigger and so on. And then you start thinking and you go like, hang on a minute, there are examples of similar initiatives which took part before and they were actually much more popular. So I wouldn't say there will be a trend of kind of renewing their relationship or kind of going totally apart. But it definitely will be, because of the media interest, which is growing, there will be definitely a bit more about the topic, which kind of makes my research more interesting. So I think it's not really going to change. It's still going to go next to each other. It's just going to be a bit more visible.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or that we might have missed out on?
Something very interesting which comes up in this intersection of music and politics, which like a lot of time you read in the newspapers about like big festivals, concerts and so on, and they are phenomenal, like appearances of politicians talking with people, making them aware of issues, young people getting engaged on those events, fantastic. But what really gets me, like in the sense like I'm like, okay, there's a chance for music and politics, are actually micro events. So there when you go for like gigs of like maximum to like 400 people, it's a small communities in the cities, in the smaller places, and you go there and it's actually all very dependent on the interaction in those communities. So kind of creating a political awareness within those communities actually has more lasting effect than the bigger concert. Because on the concert, you go, it's fun, you listen, and you kind of get aware of the issue. But if you get engaged within the smaller community, you get much more engaged and you actually get to voting because your friend told you to go voting or that he or she is going to vote. So actually, the big potential of music and politics is actually not necessarily those gigantic events, which are phenomenal and they should still be on, but it's rather those small events. And if politicians can tap in into particular communities of this scale, it's going to be much more effective.
They are nicking our shit. They totally are.
The Wire.
That was Sam talking to Pat Rosbikia, who wrote an article about Childish Gambino's This Is America. If you haven't seen the video, I highly recommend you check it out. I actually think the first time I saw it was with you guys and Maddie Matthews in the
newsroom.
Probably
was.
Yes.
Packed with metaphors.
Oh,
Maddie had so many
so
hot takes.
Hot takes galore.
Yeah. But now, the government last night announced five principles that are crucial in New Zealand for achieving pay equity. They are freedom from bias and discrimination, transparency and accessibility, acknowledging the relationship between paid and unpaid work, sustainability, and participation and engagement. I spoke to the Council of Trade Unions Vice President Rachel McIntosh about how this will help to close the gender pay gap, and I started by asking her to explain some of the more specific principles.
Yep, it's fine. Cool. I'm in the airport, which means that I can't find anywhere totally quiet. Is this all right for you?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. It's going to be really quick anyway, so I won't hold you up
okay.
for too long.
Right. Cool.
So just really quickly, you know the five principles, so I won't go through them, but I did read in the press release that you said the principles are a good step to pay and employment equity, and a lot of them are self-explanatory, like the freedom from discrimination. But would you like to elaborate on how some of the more specific ones, such as sustainability and participation and engagement, are a good step?
Sure. Yeah, well, we're the union movement, so engagement is really vital for us anyway, but that's about the people doing the work, being engaged in any solutions and any kind of design of work and steps that need to be taken to ensure that the pay gap gets closed. That's what that one's about. So that's about kind of democracy and taking people seriously. And that also goes to sustainability, because what we know is you can close a pay gap, as the nurses did about 10 years ago, and then if you just do it once, it will creep in again. And so sustainability means that you have to be vigilant and that work needs to be ongoing and that bias and discrimination need to be investigated in an ongoing way. So that's what that one's about.
Sure. And engagement and sustainability both sort of lead into how the Minister for Women, Julianne Genta, said that these principles will guide all government work on gender pay. What exactly will the implementation process of these principles be? And are you confident that these principles will become present in all workplaces?
Well, we're confident so long as there is commitment from all parties, and there is currently commitment from all parties. And part of engagement is definitely going to be ongoing commitment from the union movement. And if the union movement is engaged, then if any of the other parties looks like their engagement might slip, they will be there with a strong voice in the conversation saying, hey, we still need to keep working on this. So it needs commitment from government and needs commitment from the employers. Mm. And so as long as that happens, as long as the work is resourced, then yes, it can happen and it can make a real, actual, genuine difference in people's lives.
Can we be sure that employers will implement this, or does there need to be some kind of policy of some level of enforcement?
Well, there is currently a commitment from the state sector to do this. in the private sector. So these were designed for the public sector, but they will have application in the private sector so long as we can enforce them. And there are different ways of enforcing them. Some of it is that the unions are strong enough to ensure that it happens, and some of it is regulation. Yeah, you're right. So some of it might need laws and regulations. That is still to be worked through, that part of it.
Sure, time will tell.
Yeah.
So moving on, we've also seen that often a big cause of the pay gap is maternity leave. And so do you think that the government should hone in on that aspect of pay equity as they go forward?
Yeah, that's one of the principles, and that's one of the ones that Julianne Genter, the Minister for Women, did speak about last night when we launched it. That one of the causes, it's only one of the causes of pay stagnation women is unpaid work. And one of the principles is that unpaid work should be recognised, and it should be recognised as skilled, and that work design should take account of the skills that people have gained outside the paid workforce and recognise them and pay for them. So, yeah.
Right. And, that's quite comprehensive. I'm actually really impressed to hear about the... I didn't really acknowledge that the third one covered so much about the difference between paid and unpaid work. That's good.
Yeah.
So just to finish, do you have any final comments?
This is a really exciting work, and it will require a lot of work to make it, to see it implemented, which is what your questions have been about. And we are committed to doing that work, but it will require commitment from the government, from the employers as well, because it'll take some resources. You know, it takes time. Takes design, it takes, and some of it will take money as well.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Ko te waia, tēnei marunga BFM. You're tuned in to The Wire on 95BFM. It is 25 minutes past 12. We are just about to take a break and play you That's Not Me by Skepta, who was endorsed by Jeremy Corbyn, I believe. Well, he endorsed Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
They're mates, whatever.
They're mates. Grime for yes. Corbyn, yeah?
Grime for Corbyn. Jay Corbs is my boy.
So it's relevant to Sam Smith's interview about music and politics. Enjoy.
What you mean? Yeah. Skepta. One line flows, yeah, I got some of those. Get me, Jamie. Easy. Nah, that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, nah, that's not me. Lips any girl, nah, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, nah, that's not me. It's the return of the Mac, I'm still alive just like Tupac. Girls in the front row, girls in the back. Spit one lyric, everybody's like bruh. Flashback to the cold nights in the trap. Now I'm in a new whip, counting a big stack. Yellow gold chain and the diamonds are black. Jack me, nah, you don't wanna do that. Anytime you see me wearing a glove, boy, better know I ain't come here to fight like Jet Li. Spray this till the clip is empty. I know you get what I'm saying, you get me. Love for the G's and the N's, but we don't love no girls in the N's. Last time I fell in love with a skep, but trust me, I will never do that again. Nah, that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, nah, that's not me. Lips any girl, nah, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear LV, put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, nah, that's not me. See me, I come from the roads. Bricks wanna try and put Skepta on hold, but no. Bad boy, I've been one of those. Wake up cool, you will get one of those. One to the eyeball, one to the nose. I don't really care about your postcode. Take your girl, no dinner, no rolls. 2 minutes in my bedroom, no clothes. Girls everywhere, girls in the club. Looking at me trying to make a black man blush. Girls on the high street, girls on the bus. But these niggas wanna hang around us, that's us. I don't wanna see a Stone Island, cuz man talk shit, I just smile and flush. I'm looking for a girl with an X factor, but I don't judge like Simon does. From day one I said I was serious, then serious hit the jackpot. People ask what music I make, turn the volume up, cause that's what. I don't wear no bait designer brands, I spit deep bars in my black top. You'll never see me smoking a cigarette car, cigarette smoke car, that's not me. Nah, that's not me. Nah, that's not. When I'm on a mic in a rave, I got the whole crowd bubbling like a crackpot. See me and Skepta in a video with a nostalgic backdrop. There'll never be a day when I don't make music, cause silent, nah, that's not me. Nah, that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, nah, that's not me. Lips any girl, nah, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, nah, 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 that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any
girl, nah, that's not me. Lips any girl, nah, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, nah, that's not me.
Roll up, roll up. Grab your best buds and blaze a trail for the Hemp Store this first Thursday for a 95 BFM Drive live broadcast. With spud prizes, free DKD coffee, an evening long rolling competition, and your joint drive hosts, Johnny and Big Hungry. Everything you need to keep your spirits high. 95 BFM Drive, live from the Hemp Store, 253 Karangahape Road, 4 o'clock until 7 p.m. First Thursday, July the 5th, thanks to the K Road Business Association. Dope.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, yeah.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
So today on the International Today on the International Desk, we are going to talk about South Africa, and we're going to myth bust some awful dialogue that's been coming out on the internet in the last year or so, kind of coinciding with with the white nationalist kind of alt-right edgelord movement. And they've basically been saying there's a white genocide going on in South Africa with farmers being killed. There's been a recent study that's come out by AgriSA, the main farmers union, saying that's totally not true. So what we're going to do is we're going to explore farm attacks, we're going to explore crime in South Africa, and I'm going to give you the real stats, bust some of the myths, and yeah, let's get the truth out to you guys.
Do you have a little disclaimer though?
There is, yes. Also, sorry, I totally forgot about that.
That's
Thank you
right.
for reminding me.
Language matters, that's what I'm here
it
to
is,
say.
Yeah. So the disclaimer is that when I'm talking about South Africa, and particularly race in South Africa, the way they classify it over there and the way they monitor it and measure it is by the old apartheid classifications, because the thought process is that if we measure the development of those groups that were disadvantaged in apartheid by tracking them the way that apartheid did, hopefully that we can target better redevelopment of those groups. Now, one of those groups is called, that's why I'm going to talk about white people, I'm going to talk about black people, I'm going to talk about Indian people using those terms, and coloured people. Now, coloured in America, Britain and Canada and Australia and New Zealand is a racial epithet and it shouldn't be used. The only context in which should be used is describing this particular group in South Africa. They self-identify as Cape Coloureds. They are a mix of Khoisan, European, Malay, Pacific Islander, all sorts of other African, mix. Sure. So if you hear me say coloured, I'm referring to a particular ethnic group who identify by that word. And so just to let you know, that's what's going down.
Cool. Here we go.
Agri South Africa, one of South Africa's largest farmers' unions that represents over 70,000 commercial farmers, has released a report that states farm murders in the country are at an all-time low, in spite of what international right-wing commentators have said over the past 5 years. The country saw 47 murders between 2017 and 2018, which they say is consistent with the steady decline seen since 1998, a year where violence peaked in the country and 153 farmers were murdered on their land. Even within the last decade, this statistics showed a substantial decline from 80 to 100 people being murdered on their land from 2003 to 2011. The chair on rural safety, Cobus Breitenbach, says that farm attacks have spiked this year, but the overall trend since the turn of the century shows that they are on the decline. Breitenbach maintains this is due to farmers taking further precautions and protecting their land, as well as better communications technology that allows for faster response times from private security companies. Security risk analyst for Free State Agriculture, Jane Boyes, is part of just one organisation tracking and aiding farmers on a provincial level with the help of SAPS, the South African Police Service. Here are her organisation's findings on the matter.
In 2003, with the Commission of Inquiry into the Farm Attacks, that was the first one. they already identified. It's not only producers that's being targeted or that gets killed. It's also workers staying on farms and workers working for the farmers that's been targeted. About 70%, it can even be higher, 80% of farmers do not report crimes to the SAPS anymore. That's on property-related crimes. So it makes then the analysis and the investigation of crimes very problematic because SAPS cannot conduct a comprehensive crime pattern analysis and allocate their resources on a 20% crime pattern. It's too little. So it is a problem.
Breytenbach echoed similar sentiments, saying AgriSA also had reports from black and coloured farmers and workers regarding increased anxiety about being attacked, leading him to conclude this was a crime issue rather than a race issue. Equally, alongside the decline in farm murders, the overall murder rate per 100,000 people has been declining for the first time since it began increasing in the mid-70s. These statistics stand in stark contrast to a worrying rhetoric that has sprung up amongst the far right in Western countries about South Africa that appears to be a reflection of Western politics rather than the politics on the ground. Far-right commentators like Lauren Southern and Tommy Lahren talk of a white genocide with old white American Civil War era paranoia that black and coloured people are these vengeful savages looking for chaos and bloody retribution. Earlier this year, Australian Minister for Home Affairs Peter Dutton also came out offering humanitarian visas to specifically white South African farmers, saying, quote, "They deserve special treatment from a civilized country like ours," end quote. And to paraphrase, "We want people who come here and work hard, not people who lead a life on welfare." These comments led to a diplomatic row with Pretoria for the unashamed racial implications of these comments. On the other side of the coin, firebrand South African politician Julius Malema and his EFF party have been no better. Here's a little compilation of recent comments made by Malema that have certain communities scared of violent retribution.
"We are not calling for the slaughtering of white people, at least for now. Majority of Indians hate Africans. Majority of Indians are racist, and we must never be scared to say that. They are racist. I'm not saying all Indians. I'm saying majority of them. The same thing applies to some of the colored brothers. They see themselves as more white than being black. It's a reality we have to deal with."
"The mayor of DA in PE is a white man. So these people, when you want to hit them hard, go after a white man. They feel a terrible pain because you have touched a white man. But we are starting with this whiteness. We are cutting the throat of whiteness.
All of this leads to a public consensus whereby, despite the rate of farm murders and attacks being on the decrease, despite the general crime rate lowering, and despite South Africa being safer than it's been for decades, according to long-term trends in violent crime, the combination of political corruption, economic stagnation, and increased coverage of violent crime still means a large number of middle-class South Africans across the racial spectrum are looking for opportunities overseas. Now, this is not to say that South Africa is safe in the context to the rest of the world. South Africa is only the 123rd most peaceful country on earth out of 163, and the murder rate is the 8th highest at 33 people per 100,000 murdered each year. But the reduction of this murder rate on both farms and townships from the days of Johannesburg being the murder capital of the world show an intent from the government, law enforcement, and the general population. The discussion around farm murders and the crime rate has been diluted by rhetoric from the EFF, Afrikaner nationalist group, and white nationalist commentators overseas, and this is evidenced in the disparity between their comments and the statistics produced in studies by the University of Cape Town, farmers' unions, the South African police force, and Statistics South Africa. In essence, there are two myths that need to be busted. Contrary to popular belief, South Africa is safer than it was during the 1980s under apartheid. And secondly, that according to those who work with the farming community, the targeting of farms affects whites disproportionately because whites disproportionately own more farms than blacks, coloureds and Indians. This leads on to how South Africans envision the future of their country, as crime, violence and racial disparity are intrinsically linked to the economic development of the country as a whole. South Africa is by far the most prosperous country in Africa, and after apartheid ended, the economy had 15 years of uninterrupted, steady 3% per annum growth, leading to a large number of people rising out of poverty and the emergence of strong black, coloured and Indian middle-class communities. But the 2008 financial crisis, coupled with a decade of rampant political corruption under Jacob Zuma and the Zulu nationalist wing of the ANC, led to serious structural issues, as this SABC economic report outlines.
New figures released by Stats SA today suggest more people are finding themselves stuck in a hopeless cycle of poverty with no real chance in the formal economy. The 27.7% official jobless rate reflects 6.2 million working-age people out of work. When you include those who have stopped looking, that rate spikes to 36.4%, reflecting 9.3 million jobless people. There were 140,000 jobs created across sectors in the first quarter, not nearly enough to meet the demand of new job seekers. The Statistician General has raised the flag on the thousands of underskilled young adults leaving colleges.
For people who are tertiary other than university degrees, the unemployment of those who are 15 to 34 is very, very high at 27-28%. And it's not abating. And the question is, what is it that the system is feeding them by way of training?
The staggering 54% youth unemployment rate is being described as a ticking time bomb. Social developmental expert Lauren Graham says most young people without networks are caught up in the web of poverty, where looking for a job is too costly.
So young people from poor backgrounds typically are located far away from job opportunities, and it costs them a lot of money to go and look for work. In one of our studies, we see that on average, they can spend more than their monthly per capita household income looking for work. So it doesn't become viable to look for work.
South Africa's population is growing faster than its economy. In fact, forecasts put economic growth at around 1% this year, which means that population growth outpaces this figure by at least 0.8%. And that essentially means we are getting poorer. For the situation to be arrested, economists say we need at least 5% in our economic growth rate to keep unemployment from rising.
The current situation paints a bleak and endless circle of economic stagnation, feeding poverty, which in turn feeds violent crime, which in turn drives investors away, and so on and so forth. However, this year, new president and prolific businessman Cyril Ramaphosa hopes to change all that.
I took a view that there are more than a million companies registered in our books in South Africa, and out of these million companies, I took a view that if, say, half of them are still alive and operating, and each one created just one job for a young person, we would have 500,000 jobs created by each company that is registered on our books as a nation. And that is where the 500,000 jobs that are asked for came in. And if we, in the next year, could create 500,000 jobs for young people, which, if you were to extrapolate a little bit more, you could start touching on 750,000 and 1 million jobs, we could make a real serious dent on youth unemployment.
South Africa has a lot going for it. It's a modern country with great transport and urban infrastructure. It has an independent judicial system and a large English-speaking population. It sits on what is still a major shipping route and still ranks as a top destination for retirees from Europe. But its economic woes and the violent effects of it have meant a lot of its better-off citizens are seeking prospects elsewhere and causing a brain drain. South Africa is on the correct track with regard to its crime epidemic, but much much like Ramaphosa, the majority of South Africans across this racial spectrum want to live, work and eat in peace and comfort. And the dangerous rhetoric of the Malemas, Southerns, Larens and Richard Spencers of the world don't seem to be aiding that cause. In short, South Africans deserve better than to be used as a crude political weapon in a bigger ideological fight. Yep, and if you are a South African out there who has moved to New Zealand and you are listening, or if you've even been to South Africa, you know, let me know what your experience was. Let me know how you found it. And I know we talked about a lot about violent crime, and I don't want to be a tourism ad, but it's as a visitor, it's still 100% worth visiting. It's a beautiful country, 100% should go. I've been, I loved it, but you do have to be aware of your surroundings. So, any South Africans out there, let me know. Get in touch.
Always an advocate, Connor.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
From the 1st of July, anyone convicted of two or more drink driving offences within 5 years, or any first-time offenders caught driving more than 3.2 times the legal alcohol limit, will be subject to an alcohol interlock sentence. This is a device that prevents people who are intoxicated from driving. Laura Quigstad spoke to the CEO of No One Ever Stands Alone, Leah Abrams, on the matter, asking what her thoughts were on the recent change.
Yep. So as I understand it, the interlocks have been brought in to stop repeat drunk drivers from getting behind the wheel and stopping them from driving drunk, and that they have to blow into a breathalyzer before the vehicle will actually start. Our opinion as an organization is really that the interlock system really stops a drunk driver from becoming a repeat offender, and it's really the only device that we currently have, you know, worldwide that really stops someone who's a repeat drunk driver from driving.
How much do you think repeat offenders really account for the number of drunk driving incidents we have in this country?
Well, we haven't actually found enough research to know how much repeat drunk drivers affect crimes in the country. However, Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the U.S. actually has a stat that they've said that 1.77 million drunk drivers have been prevented from starting their vehicles as a result of the interlock system being installed across the United States. You know, obviously that's on a much larger scale than New Zealand, but we definitely know that this does prevent people from getting behind the wheel and when they've consumed alcohol.
And for our listeners, can you kind of explain what the state of drunk driving is in New Zealand currently?
Yeah, so the state of drunk driving in New Zealand currently is that we know that out of all one-third of all road deaths are related to alcohol or drug use. And, we also know that their roll toll has been going up over the last couple of years. And so the amount of people who've been affected or who lost their lives due to drunk or drug driving is increasing year on year.
The kind of counter that I believe always comes up when these kinds of systems go into place is the cost on the taxpayer of having these things installed in people's cars. How do you think that mentality is coming about?
You know what, I think we're not looking on the facts, and if we have to measure the cost of someone's life being taken or the injury sustained as a result of a drunk driver and the cost of on society and the cost to us as taxpayers, I think there's actually no comparison to having the interlock system installed with repeat drunk drivers so that we can prevent deaths on our roads, further deaths on our roads and further injuries on our roads as well.
So this is a big step for your organization, but how do you hope to see in the next few years government take things further to prevent these kinds of drunk driving incidents?
Well, Laura, I think there's a lot of steps that all of us can take together. Our message is really simple. NESA believes that we can all make a difference to end drunk driving in New Zealand. I think it's going to be a combined effort of stakeholders, both from government and from the not-for-profit and other special interest groups, to really come together and help to make decisions. I don't think government has all the answers on how to end drunk driving. I think one thing that, you know, as an organization we see is really important is providing the resources for the police, so whether it's further resourcing or also providing them with the opportunity to do saliva testing at checkpoints. I see that as a really good good first step going forward, and I just think there's lots more to do whether it comes to road safety, making our roads safer, and also giving the police further resourcing to help combat drunk driving and drugged driving on our roads.
Perfect. That's all my questions. Any other comments you want to make?
No, if anybody wants to find out how to get involved in drunk driving in New Zealand, they can reach us at nessa.org.nz.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Hey, Simplicity B-Card family, you folk are tops. As a thank you for supporting 95BFM, we've got together with some mates and sussed some righteous discounts just for you, including
10% off online with Fume, 20% off online at Skullcandy, and 10% off everything at Arcade. T's and C's apply.
Support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month with a Simplicity B card. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Kia tō te rangi marie, o rangi nui e tui honei, o papu tuanuku e takatonei, o te tai ao e awhinei I a tātou, tihei Māori ora.
This is the Green Desk on 95BFM.
Our Green Desk friend Jack Marshall is eating camembert at the beach in New Caledonia as we speak, so he couldn't join us today. But of course, before he left, he spoke to Eric Warrant, who is a biologist at the University of Lund in Sweden. He is the principal investigator of a study that has found that moths migrate using a magnetic sense.
You've been looking at how moths use kind of these... I'm going to butcher whatever is the truth, but in my own words, you've been looking at how moths use kind of like the Earth's magnetic fields to migrate. But I thought a good point could be just starting out exactly what exactly kind of like moths are, where they live, like how they live, like, you know, big kind of colonies of them, if you are. Because last week on the show, we just had a good friend of mine in about butterflies, and they seem to be in the same kind of family. Butterflies just a little bit more kind of colourful.
Yes, they're in the same sort of order of insects, which is the Lepidoptera, which are the butterflies and moths. So yeah, they're really closely related. But moths are, there's very little distinguishing features between them, apart from the fact that moths are fairly nocturnal in their habits on the whole. There are exceptions, but most of them are nocturnal, whereas most butterflies, and again there are exceptions, are active only in the daytime and tend to be more brightly coloured.
And do they have, they live in like large kind of colonies, would you say, or is that...
Yes, well, the moths themselves, they are sort of dispersed all over southeastern Australia for during their juvenile stages, so as larvae and pupae. But when they hatch in the spring here in Australia and start their migration, then they end up in the Australian mountains. They come from all different directions. They all end up in our highest mountains just near Canberra and enter cool caves up in the mountains, but then they're aggregated in incredible numbers. So they're in a dormant state, but they come in and enter the caves, and then they land on the cave walls, and there they aggregate in incredible density. So there are about 17,000 moths per square metre of cave wall.
That's a couple.
yeah, that's a couple. Yep, so they're there for 3 or 4 months in that state. And then they sort of wake up out of that dormant state at the end of the summer, beginning of the autumn, and then they leave the caves and they return to where they came from, where they were born, basically. And when they get there, they mate, lay their eggs, and then they die.
And so in your research, you've been looking at how they use kind of how they travel, how they migrate. So what have you really like found?
Right. Well, the interesting question for us was, how do these moths, when they hatch, as adults in the spring in these far-flung areas of southeastern Australia, how do they know which direction to go and how far to get to these caves, having never been there before? And remember, their parents have been dead for several months, so there's been no kind of personal experience passed down from any parent. So they just have this in their heads when they're born. So there must be some kind of inherited migratory direction that they have, and there must be cues that they know about genetically that help them to know when to stop. So the first part of our questioning of how they actually did this is to work out, well, how is it that they can fly in the right direction? And so we started to study the kind of sensory cues that we know that other animals have used as compass cues for navigational tasks. I must confess, thought that they would be using visual cues from the sky, like the stars and the moon, as we discovered in other nocturnal insects that navigate over very short distances. These are dung beetles. This is work I've done in the past. I thought that these moths would be using the stars and the moon as well. But for a very long navigational time frame, like in their case, they migrate all night, every night, over many, many nights in a row, maybe even weeks. And during this time, these cues are incredibly fickle. The moon it comes up and goes down at different times, if it's up at all, and it changes shape and intensity, and it also changes the path across which it moves over the sky. So it's an incredibly unreliable cue. And that's when it started to dawn on us that maybe there was something more stable that they could be using, and then the Earth's magnetic field became the cue that we thought they might be able to use, and we started to investigate that.
It's quite fascinating, really, because I think it's actually quite hard for us as humans to understand these animals, that they just kind of wake up and ready to go, and they kind of have this genetic knowledge in them, because as humans, we basically can't do anything for about 25 years, as I'm slowly starting to learn. But so, do you know, like, what it would be like in the kind of fundamental level, like, what is actually happening to these moths? Are they just kind of following their nose, or are they, you know, just picking up on some... Because obviously they don't know that they're following electromagnetic, you know.
No.
Like, what do you think is actually going on in their heads?
Right, that's something that's a very interesting question that other people have asked as well in regards to other animals that are known to use the Earth's magnetic field. So these moths are not the first animal known to use the Earth's magnetic field. And part of the reason why we started to think about this was that we knew that there were other nocturnally migrating animals, notably birds, that have been well known for a long time to be able to navigate using the Earth's magnetic field over tremendous distances, like from northern Europe to Africa and back again. So that's where we got the idea. But exactly how this information from the Earth's magnetic field is sensed by animals and processed by animals in the brain is completely unknown. So it's actually the last sense we really know almost nothing about. We know about vision, we know about hearing, we know about smell in incredible detail, but magnetic sensation is more or less completely not understood. There are a few, or a couple at least, of hypotheses how magnetic information might be turned into a neural signal that could be used by the brain to understand what the information is telling the animal. But so far, we've actually never found the sensor, the actual group of cells, or maybe it's just a single cell, or even a small organ. We have no idea where it's located in the body, and we have no idea how it works in any animal. So that remains a mystery, I'm afraid.
Do you think that as humans we might have some kind of like receptors or affected by magnetic, or even like, I know this is kind of definitely getting out of your speciality with moths traveling, but just kind of hypothesizing, do you think we as humans have any of these kind of... I don't know, inputs that we just don't really know about yet?
Well, in regards to the senses at least, we know of all of these senses like vision and hearing and magnetoreception. We don't know of any other sense that's kind of unknown yet, at least. I mean, I'm not saying that there isn't one. But when it comes to magnetic sense, at least, it's very controversial as to whether humans have this sense or not. There are a couple of people who claim that we have it, but the experiments that they've done have been difficult to replicate. So this has created some degree of controversy. I personally myself have got no feeling that I can sense the Earth's magnetic field, and I think most people you ask would come to the same kind of conclusion. So, I mean, the classic kinds of experiments you'd have to do to show this would be, for instance, to have a kind of a training experiment, a behavioral experiment, where you have to be able to detect differences in the field. You can make some animals do experiments like that, but I doubt very sincerely whether we ourselves as human beings could do that same type of test and succeed.
It's not exactly the answer I was hoping for, but, you know, I think that's kind of how science works sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as evidence of the fact that we probably can't sense the magnetic field all that well is that we've invented compasses to go on hikes with that we actually have in our pockets, which tell us the direction of the Earth's magnetic field and therefore every other compass direction as a result. And we have to rely on that when we go hiking in the bush. We can't rely on our own so-called magnetic sense if we've even got such a thing.
Yeah, extremely boringly cognitive beings, but we get the job done.
We do, but we've got our intelligence allows us to invent devices that do the job for us.
That was the Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Order.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Tuesday. We've had a couple of texts in. Connor, at the end of his international segment today, said that if any South Africans had any responses or if you'd been to South Africa, and Paul has got in touch to say that he doesn't think South Africans should come to the North Shore of Auckland in such a high volume. He thinks that culturally they are different and aggressive, and that we should have more refugees instead. I think I definitely agree that our immigration should take up more refugees.
I'll be honest, I'm probably not in the best situation to do the whole coming over here taking our jobs line with me and my British accent. I see both sides. I see why people come here, because they want safety and they want the safe life for their kids and the future for their kids and the opportunities. But also I understand the other point of view, which is staying in the country and trying to do something about it. So I think South Africans are torn. I think that's a choice for the individual.
Yeah.
Personally.
I don't know, man. With a name like Paul, sounds Pākehā. We're all immigrants, aren't we? Our ancestors were.
Yeah, I'm just a bit more recent.
We also had a lovely Texan who said that the only place that you get real journalism, is on The Wire and Al Jazeera. So thank you. That's lovely.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And thank you also to everyone who came on our show today. We had Pat Rosbikia, Rachel McIntosh, Leah.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.